Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. And this episode is part of a short series made in partnership with Brenntag. Today, we're focusing on alternative proteins. We're hearing more and more about these products, and it's never been easier to find them on our supermarket shelves. But there are challenges, particularly around meat alternatives. There's a huge amount of work being done right around the world to get things like the taste and texture just right. And for some, the idea of completely removing meat from their diet just isn't on the cards. So, where are we up to and where are we heading when it comes to alternative proteins? I'm delighted to be joined by two people who can guide us through. First of all, we have Tayab Haq, Technical Sales Manager at Brenntag. Hello there, Tayab.
Hello.
Good to see you again. And we've got Louisa Marshall, Technical Sales Manager, and she sits on Brenntag's EMEA Expert Panel for Meat and Plant-Based Foods. Hello, Louisa.
Hello, Stefan.
Brilliant to have you as well. So let's start by setting the scene a little. How big a market is there for meat alternatives? Where does that fit within the overall alternative protein market? And what sources of protein are most popular in this category? So that's three questions, admittedly, but Tayab, you can take us through that.
I'll try to run through them gently. So we start with a European survey indicates that the global meat alternative retail market will reach about a value of $26 billion by 2024, and around the same time the milk alternative market will reach about $25 billion. To put that into context, the global alternative protein market is worth around about $15 billion on there. So that gives an idea of the size of the market. In terms of the more popular proteins in use, if we look at just preferred alternative proteins, a survey across UK, Germany, France and Spain indicates potato, rice and oat are the top three within there. Now that's obviously driven mostly by the massive expansion that we've seen in non-dairy milks, alternative milks within there. But then zoning in terms of meat alternatives, soya and pea are still the two most popular sources. Reason for this is twofold: cost and all-round functionality. However, what we are seeing more and more is a combination of pea and wheat protein is becoming increasingly popular. One of the reasons for this is it helps to overcome the challenges of sustainably sourcing soya, particularly from countries around the South America region. If anything, pea protein launches are actually outgrowing and outpacing ones launches with soya products in them.
Now, what about people's eating habits? Because we've heard of lots of different sort of phases of there's veganism, vegetarianism, flexitarianism, all these different concepts. Are more and more of us completely turning our backs on eating meat? And what is it that consumers are looking for?
But again, looking at the data, so UK data this time, seems to indicate that about one in three meat eaters have reduced their meat consumption. But at the same time, one in four dairy consumers have also reduced their consumption of animal-based dairy products. However, again, putting it into context, only 3% of UK consumers actually view themselves as vegetarian, and only 1% actually classify themselves as vegan. These are typical behavioural traits we see in a consumer group that we at Brenntag term as the conscious consumer. The conscious consumer actively makes choices for foods when they're buying, so it has to be from a sustainable source, or they may be deliberately avoiding or reducing consumption of certain foods, such as red meat, for health reasons, primarily. Although they may also have concerns around sustainability as well and carbon footprint. Growing forward, there is an expectation that the conscious consumers will be expecting a vegan alternative in every possible category. For flexitarian, and by flexitarian, I define that as somebody who's predominantly plant-based diet with occasionally eating meat. This is where we at Brenntag believe that hybrid foods will come more to the fore. They provide an important bridge between animal and plant-based diets. The flexitarian market is generally seen as the biggest areas for growth and innovation potential. You've got more access to a wider range, obviously, of raw materials within there. These are also able to reduce products with reduced meat content, but a more balanced amino acid profile in contrast to products that are purely vegetarian or vegan. We also, going back to the conscious consumer group that we mentioned, being flexitarian is a conscious and deliberate long-term choice It's not just a gateway to going into a meat-free diet, because not all people are able to do that and switch overnight. Almost kind of doing it by stealth is a way of maybe weaning people off an exclusively carnivorous diet on there. Now, where there may be a nutrient gap, and this is where one of the first challenges comes in terms of nutrient deficiency for vitamins and minerals, this is where ourselves, Brenntag, we can step in with some optimized, pre-optimized mixes, which can be used across either hybrid or vegan products.
So as well as all of that, I guess I'm thinking about myself. I'm a bit of a gold digger as well. You know, I'll go to a restaurant, and if something looks particularly fascinating on the menu and it's vegan, I think I'll go for that. I'm the gastronaut. I'm the one who's there for the adventure as well. So there are so many different sectors of different types of people looking for different experiences as well. So, you know, whether or not it's I'm feeling particularly vegan that day, I'd sometimes just go for it because I love it. Okay, so now we have a set of products here. Louisa, tell us what we've got.
Okay, so with the first product that I'd like you to taste today, Stefan, is a chicken and vegetable meatball. This is a great example of the hybrid meat trend. Hybrid meat products are foods where a portion of meat has been replaced by other plant-based ingredients or proteins. So we've taken some lovely British chicken and we've added some vegetables, peppers and spinach. Then we've added a touch of garlic and some lemon for flavour.
There'll be a bit of clanking, sorry, as I turn my pan on here. I hope that's all right.
Yeah, go for it. And then we've added some texturised ingredients, methyl cellulose, vegetable fibres and chicory root fibre. No matter what kind of plant-based meatball you're making, there's a general recipe to follow. And I want to break that down into sort of three main building blocks for you today. Firstly, the main ingredient really is the plant protein that you're using. As Ty mentioned earlier, the most popular are pea and soya. And you can use texturized and isolate. I find that those two working together create the best combination. Secondly, then there's the flavour. Really important is flavour. You can be as simple as adding just herbs and spices, or you can be more complex and use natural flavourings and masking agents. These really help to make the product taste like beef or chicken. And lastly, but really important, is the texturising and binding ingredients. At Brenntag, we call this building block a food solution. By combining ingredients such as starches, fibres, hydrocolloids and preservatives, these really help to create the texture, firmness and juiciness, and they can also support the shelf life of the end product. These are the ingredients that really make a product taste like real meat and give it you that wow factor.
There must be a huge amount of experimentation. I must say, they look great.
Oh, I'm so pleased.
I mean, and I think that's, you know, it's a multi-sensory experience, isn't it? You know, it's getting them out of the packet, putting them in a pan and looking at them as well. It's not just the final thing that you put in your mouth. It's the whole journey that you go through. And so what have we got? So these are chicken. They've got some chicken in. And what's the sales kind of point for your customers? What is the bit that they're after? Is it about a specific amount of chicken, or is it just about the fact that it is a hybrid and it works at all?
I think that adding vegetables to a protein product really encourages the flexitarian market to make meat less important less important in their diet. And I think that's why people tend to go for hybrid meat products.
Okay, right, I can hear a fair bit of sizzling going on inside here. This is all happening in the studio. I have written a risk assessment for this, I promise you. So I've also just added another product that you sent over. It's a meat-free sausage. Tell us all about that.
Okay, this is 100% vegan, so it's made using soya proteins.
So it's a very different concept, presumably, you know, and technically very, very different for you to deal with.
Yeah, slightly differently, because you've got only plant-based proteins and they do behave differently to animal-based proteins, for sure. So then we've added some herbs and some natural flavours, and then we've texturised that with methyl cellulose and chicory root fibre. This product also has coconut fat in it, coconut oil, and I really think that's a really good fat to use in plant-based meat products, you know, because it gives you the appearance of animal fat through the product, and it melts really well on cooking, creating, like, you know, a really nice juicy texture. In the end, though, making a vegan sausage is very similar to making a meatball. You really just need the three building blocks. The type of protein that you're using, the flavours that you're using, and then the all-important texturising food solution. So, you know, with that then, the processing, so the manufacturing equipment that you use would be slightly different, because obviously the sausages would then be filled into casings where a meatball would just be sort of hand-rolled or machine-rolled to create the shape.
Okay, now the studio is beginning to fill with the appropriate smells of the Maillard reaction happening on the proteins here. I'm loving the work. So they're not quite ready yet. So could you tell me about what the main challenges are when you're dealing with these things? What are the big hurdles and how do you overcome them?
Okay, there's quite a few challenges when making plant-based meat products. I think the most common we're asked about is obviously creating a meat-type texture. And I think that is probably the biggest challenge. We've done an awful lot of work in the background on creating you know, and combining the right ingredients together to sort of optimise the characteristics of a traditional meat type analogue product. You know, to get you that specific fibrous and juicy like texture, because plant proteins just don't possess that at all, and you have to use texturised ingredients to mimic this. I think also I'm asked a lot about flavour. Plant proteins inherently don't have a neutral flavour, and with that, they can be quite hard to mask. Some people describe it as a bitter taste. So we find that we using masking agents and flavourings and herbs and spices on top of that really do, you know, help to create a much nicer flavour and reduce that bitterness. And then, of course, I think one of the things that we've not really touched on, we touched a lot on taste and texture, is nutritional profile. And that's really important, I think, because plant-based proteins don't have, again, the same nutritional profile as a meat product. And I think that's really important to ensure that, you know, that people are eating healthy foods. So, you know, often I like to combine soya protein with pea protein, because that'll give you a complete amino acid profile, and that really helps with the nutritional profile. We've also got some great vitamins and minerals which are you can use to fortify, so enhance some of the vitamin content in the product as well. So by using a building block approach, you know, to your recipe development, you can create, you know, a really nice plant-based analog product.
Well, it's smelling fantastic, I have to say. The sausage, they crisp up nicely. I mean, I guess all these other things are important, you know, that they brown properly, that they perform in the pan in the way that you might expect, because we have all that anticipation of a meat product, and we want things, you know. And you might say, well, you don't really need that, but you might want to see it, kind of thing. So all these things must be so tricky to get to. Okay, now I know that strictly speaking, it's illegal to do any tasting with tomato ketchup, but seeing as I've never tasted a sausage in my life without ketchup, then I'm going to have some anyway, because I don't want to mess with the concept, you know what I mean? So shall I go for the meatball first?
Go for it.
Okay. Okay, so yeah, all the textures there, and that's the thing that you were saying was one of the really tricky things, is to get that fibrous texture, and that's got it all. Yeah, I think also the fact that it's got a variety of different sort of specks of is it pepper or chili and spinach and bits and pieces? It's got interest to it as well. It, you know, it does actually look fascinating. It looks like you're on a little taste journey, as well as the senses kicking off. You've got the anticipation because your brain's saying, "Oh, yep, that looks good. Oh, yeah, it's fantastic." And still really nice and moist as well. And I was wondering if it was going to taste really dry, because obviously with a lower meat content, you're expecting a lower fat content. So I'm really surprised by that. Right, I'll save the rest for later on. Okay, it's just a little bit. So,
are you going to have tomato ketchup with your sausages as well?
It's damn right I am. I will. Okay, I will lower myself to tasting one mouthful without it. Okay. All right. So they've browned really nicely. It looks like a fantastic banger. Uh huh. Oh, and again, still really juicy. And I was expecting not to have that juiciness. That huge protein hit, that full umami profile that you'd expect from a nicely seared banger. I mean, that is a decent banger, I'd say there. Okay, now I'm going to go in for a bit of ketchup so I can actually judge it properly. Yeah. That is surprisingly good, I have to admit. I wouldn't normally go for a vegan banger, but that is absolutely fantastic. That would easily take the place of a meat banger. Plus, I suppose I then feel good about it as well. I need to test these on the kids as well, see what they're going to get from it. But also, I was sort of expecting a little bit more, you know, that you'd chuck a bit more salt in, you know, to make up for a lack of the proteins. But it doesn't taste particularly salty. In fact, it's got all the protein hit, but I might even chuck a bit more salt on. But then that's the that's for me to do in the house, isn't it? So I'm really impressed by that. So what was the trickiest bit to get right with the sausage?
Oh, definitely the texture, yeah. Flavour and colour, quite much more simple to get right, but it's definitely the texture to mimic, you know, the a meat-like texture and juiciness and firmness and everything holding together as well, so that you can actually manufacture it correctly. So every, you know, it's easy to go through a processing plant and every product come out the same.
All these things that the consumer never, ever has to think about, but is absolutely key to your job.
Yeah, and on all of our customers as well, you know, it's really key for them that they can successfully scale up a recipe development formulation that's then going to scale up and work through their factory.
Yeah. So, Louisa, how does the process work when a customer comes to you? What's the process of developing one of these products? Do they already know what they want to do, or do you work with them to guide them to developing their own products?
I think the simple answer is I think we do both. I think the most important thing is that we listen to our customers, really, and that way we can, you know, together find the right solution. So we can help with the ingredient selection, the product formulation, and then guidance on the process optimization. We've got a huge range now of plant-based proteins, and we're always working in the background to put those ingredients together to best effect. And, you know, we can offer bespoke development. We've got a UK Food Application and Development Centre. We've got a technologist there who's happy to create a tailor-made product based on the customer brief. And, you know, we find quite a lot of success in that collaboration between us as a supplier and the customer. I think we've felt that we've helped to speed up, you know, the customer's innovation program and then the ultimate, you know, market launch.
Okay. Now, Tybe, you're going to have to do some more talking, really, because I've got a couple more sausages to finish here and I'm determined to get through them. So Louisa spoke about partnering on innovation with your customers. Why is this partnership so important?
It's essential. I mean, neither ourselves nor our manufacturing customers have all the answers to every single challenge in isolation. So a collaborative way of working with a good two-way level of trust often delivers the best outcome. We understand ingredients, our customers understand their manufacturing competencies and capabilities, I mean, allied to that, we don't just have the expertise within our own food and application development centre in the UK. We have access to information and recipes and trends from another 30 worldwide. So we've got a big kind of window out on the world. I mean, having come from a manufacturing background, I know only too well, you could be competing for 5 slots with a big retailer, and you may, at the concept stage initially, have to show probably about 35 to 40 iterations before you actually get it all whittled down. Now, what we have been able to do with some of our customers in the past is arrange a session at our Food and Development Centre in Widnes, where we can do a lot of funneling early on. And that would normally, in a manufacturing environment, that would be a process where you'd have to do that on top of your other regular work, and it would take a couple of weeks. We can do that in a couple of days, and it helps to kind of do that little funneling at an early stage so it can refine the types of concepts that they then want to take forward to their retailer for an initial concept submission.
So let's wrap this up by looking on a broader scale. What does the future look like for alternative protein? What are the big trends on the horizon? I mean, we know, as you said, it's a massive, massive market now. But how is that going to get more specific? And what are the trends that you can spot in there?
Well, you will get some newer plant-based proteins coming to the fore. But what's really key here is the ones that are non-allergenic, can demonstrate scalability, so you know you can grow them, you can grow them in a sustainable way, you can supply them all year round. These are the ones more likely to cross into the mainstream and stay there. Recent survey across Europe, Middle East and Africa indicated the 3 fastest growing proteins were fava bean, almond and sunflower. Now, recent events worldwide have indicated that maybe some of those might not be so easy to access. So something else that comes to the fore is maybe using a different mix of plant-based proteins to give optimized nutritional delivery. That's becoming more and more common. But there's also a school of thinking that actually plant-based proteins, we've taken the growing kind of part of it as far as we can go. What can we actually do in the actual technology with using things like precision fermentation? That could very well lead the next wave of plant proteins that are nutritionally complete. And actually, because of the fermentation angle, have a more interesting take on flavour. You might get more inherent umami delivery within there. If you think about the sources for this kind of precision fermentation, fungi, yeast, single-cell algae, and the whole point on there is influencing the microorganisms to create a protein structure similar to things like casein, whey, albumin. One of the big benefits of using that type of process is a much lower carbon footprint, less water intensive than either harvesting plant proteins or raising cattle. So the other kind of things that certainly are already around are trying to get replication of whole pieces of muscle in a plant protein format. So that, you know, you have some kind of versions of a steak, but if you wanted to get like a whole joint, if you wanted to get like, you know, something similar to like a quarter chicken or a half chicken, high moisture extrusion techniques allow a layering of plant fibers to give a kind of mimic a pulled meat type texture. Plant-based fish actually is an area where there's still a quality gap to be bridged. Main challenge is how to get the flaking texture on something like a tuna. At Brenntag, we do have solutions to help deliver fish analogs in either a nugget or tuna style format, mostly based on soya. But more and more we're looking outside to incorporating other proteins within that as well.
Well, there's a huge amount of exciting developments on the horizon. So I look forward to talking to you again in the future to find out how all of these things unfold. Tayyab and Louisa, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like assistance from Brenntag with your development projects, you can contact them via their website, brenntag.com. And remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe on your preferred platform so you never miss an episode. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review?